Okay, so today is going to be the second lecture on the information extraction, where actually we will I'll talk about two methods I quickly went through last time, which is writing wrappers and also using natural language grammar to sometimes extract useful patterns about facts. Okay, we'll talk about those two. I mentioned them very briefly at the end of last class. And then actually I changed my mind and I'm actually going to spend most of today's class talking about sequence classification and basically using hidden Markov models to do information extraction. That's something that I mentioned last time that I won't do, but that's what I decided I'll do more today. Okay, so that's the background on today's class. Are there any questions before I start? None. Okay. So, as I said, you know, we're going to be looking at this unwrapping, you know, computing, basically extracting data by writing wrappers, which essentially unwraps structured data which has been put in pseudo English form or some templated form. That's the first idea. That's the easiest kind of extraction, and basically the DOM tree for the web page can often be useful in writing the pattern that you have to look for on the page. Okay, so for example, on this one we are saying if you want to get the book name, then you can start through this HTML body and go for the bold lettering and then take whatever character data is there. Instead of having character data here, sometimes you can actually also have a regular expression, okay, and then you extract something from that regular expression. That's also possible. Now, again, this is the direct use of the fact that many, many pages are highly, highly structured and regular, okay. So, as I mentioned last time, there's a lot of regularity on the web, but when the machines produce these pages, they're like completely regular. Okay, every one of them is exactly the same pattern. And so those cases, essentially you would be able to write unwrappers, okay, or they call them wrappers. There's a lot of work that's been done on this. It's sort of become technology right now. In, you know, 10 years back when this stuff was the first time it was being done, you know, some of the earliest internet companies actually started with this idea of writing wrappers and maintaining the wrappers. Another example of a wrapper here, so this is from another system from like ISI, where essentially they would allow people to, you know, it's sort of in generating the wrapper, you might be, they may be a semi-automated tool, so you would actually go and, you know, highlight Lindbergh and say title, and then it will figure out that the best way to get the title is this expression here. Okay, and then you will highlight this expression here and say price, and it will again figure out, you know, the best way to get the price out of it. Okay, so this is most likely, this would have been generated automatically for you from this page, and there are programs available for supporting this kind of a thing. Now, of course, the assumption then is obviously if you rerun this, this is sort of like macros. You're writing keyboard macros in almost. If you rerun this on this page, clearly you're going to get back the title and price. The real question is the use of this is this now can be run on any page from Amazon, and hopefully you will be able to get author, title, price, availability. So you just basically extracted an NRE relation with basically 100% accuracy. This is, you know, unexpected. You don't expect that unless, in fact, this is a machine-generated page, which is always using the same exact. So previously, it was really, this is probably what Amazon had in its database, and it generated this for you so that it will be visually pleasing, and then these rules are essentially decoding it back. That's what you're doing. Now, of course, the tricky part, which as I mentioned last time, is if suddenly a little thing changes here. In fact, the, you know, the, what may have changed here is the font size may have been reduced. Okay, notice that in fact this rule, even though I'm not particularly interested in the syntax they're using, it uses even things like the font size becomes one more and then you end, for example. So they're almost looking for the exact pattern that occurred there before and after the title. Okay, now of course if there's a minor change, then essentially you're going to get junk. Okay, so if you run the same rule on this page now, after that Lindbergh changes slightly, I mean just the display of it changed, you might get author is nil, title is nil, and of course price did not get affected, availability did not get affected. Now the interesting thing of course is then that you will be getting a lot of junk data by this, and so you need to maintain wrappers. Okay, not only do you write a wrapper, you need to make sure that the other guy who doesn't owe you anything, because Amazon didn't care that you were screen scraping from them. If they really wanted to help you out, they would have provided API connection to their database. Okay, right now you're doing it without telling them, and so if they change, then you fall down. No, and so basically you need to kind of, so there is a whole ecology for wrappers. You have to essentially generate a wrapper, you have to keep maintaining it. If it starts doing wrong things, then you have to recompute the wrapper. Okay, there are some of these things which can be automated. For example, it's possible that in fact suddenly you start getting very different kind of entities into this column, then you should be able to realize that they don't seem to belong to the class title. So presumably based on yesterday's extraction, you figured out these are all the examples of class title. Okay, so you can learn a classifier for, given something, is it likely to be a title or not? Like for example, 21.00 is not likely to be a title. Okay, and when you start seeing a whole bunch of entities in this column which are not of that class, as you have learned previously, then you can at least the program can raise an alarm, and then the humans can come into the loop and then, redo the wrapper. Yes. No, but this may not, I'm not even talking about, in this particular case, I wound up taking the same exact page, but this could have happened if in fact in a different page about some other book, things have changed. So it's not that I'm recrawling necessarily, in this case, it just so happened that this example is Lindbergh book in both pages, but this could have been the IR book. And it just, the assumption that you have is that once a machine is producing these pages, it will be not just similar, identical in the pattern. And that's what you're exploiting. Okay? When we get to the next part, we'll see that, in fact, when people write it, when there are people involved in this, it'll never be identical. As I mentioned last time, although most papers have titles on the top and then followed by author name, followed by abstract, there's a huge number of variations in between. Okay, and because of which, when you extract titles and authors like this, you tend to fall flat. And that's where we talk about sequence classification in a minute. Okay, so this is, completely using the fact that somebody, that the data, the pages are generated with identical schema. Okay, so as I said, in fact, this whole thing happens because you don't have direct access to the source. So if in fact, if you have access to the source, then you probably don't even need to do this screen scraping. You can just have a direct access to the database. In this particular example, we looked at, basically these expressions, they're really expressions based on the parse tree of the page, where the parse tree happened to be the DOM tree, because all pages have the same exact HTML grammar. All these Amazon pages have the same exact HTML grammar. That's what you're exploiting in this case. Okay? So the other interesting question is, well, if you're exploiting grammar, then there is actually grammar for normal natural language too. Okay? And so one idea is, if I give you a sentence, you can essentially do tagging of that sentence and get noun phrases, word phrases out, for example. And then you can do things like this, which is extracting facts from unstructured text. Not structured, but unstructured text. Okay. So this is what I was mentioning last time. So here you're saying cities such as Boston, Los Angeles, Seattle. If you read this, you would like to say that, well, that means that Boston is a city, Los Angeles is a city, Seattle is a city, clearly. Now, what is the pattern here? It's not just for cities, it is like things such as thing one, thing two, thing three. So class, basically, this is the class information, these are the instance information. Now, how do you capture them in the sentence? One idea is to realize that you can say the class and then such as noun phrase 1, noun phrase 2, and noun phrase 3. If you ever find that pattern, then you can write this down as three facts, saying head of this NP1 is a instance of this class, NP2 is instance of this class, NP3 is instance of this class. Okay. Now clearly, unlike the Amazon, so there is a kind of an analogy here between the thing that we did with Amazon page and the thing we are doing here. Both of them we are looking for the pattern. The difference, of course, is that here there are multiple exceptions to the rule that we just made. So, for example, if I say I listen to pretty much all music but prefer country such as Garth Brooks, right? And you would actually say Garth Brooks is a country. And that's not a good fact. Okay. So the interesting thing in this kind of scenario is you could write, these are called, I think, hyponyms. There's a name for this, I forget. Did I write the name for this? These sorts of patterns are called, I think, hyponyms, but I will look it up and let you know. So these are general patterns that sort of hold, but they have enough exceptions. The question, of course, is if there are exceptions, how are you going to put them in the database? Right? Okay, sometimes if you do this, you will get the price. Some other times, you will get some random number. That's not going to be good. So one interesting question in doing the same idea that you did for Amazon, but for the text, is the facts that you get, these are only candidate facts. They may probably be facts, but they may not be facts. Okay, so you need to assess them. Okay, now one idea in this particular case, you know, in this particular work that people did this, what they used is use Google back to check whether or not these facts are true. Okay, so it's kind of cute. So in some sense, this extends this point that web is not random at all. Okay, and it is generated by people. And so if you just figured out according to this that Seattle is a city, is it really true? Well, one idea is you can, if you are trying to write the fact Seattle is a city, you want to know how likely is it that Seattle is really a city. Okay. One idea could be to essentially take the ratio of the number of pages which have Seattle and city next to each other, essentially, divided by the number of pages which have Seattle in it. That's, roughly speaking, the probability that Seattle is a city. Right? So I'm just using, remember long back I mentioned, this was my water flows upwards versus downward example. Martians can use this to figure out whether water is flowing upward or downward. Okay? And you also can check what is the spelling in the old days. Now, of course, you know, the spelling is given right away, but in the old days, one of my students I mentioned used to check whether it's a good sentence or not by just throwing that sentence at Google. And if it finds enough instances of it in other papers, then it's a good sentence. Okay, so again, you're using the web itself as a way of assessing the veracity of the fact. So notice that the pattern for extraction is based on the grammar, but then once you extract the fact, you're separately evaluating whether or not it's a fact. In the Amazon case, there is no such question. You are not asking yourself, now that I figured out Lindbergh is a title, is it really true that Lindbergh is a title? Is it really true that the author of Lindbergh is somebody else? You just take it for granted. Here you're going to question this. Okay. So as an example in this case, if you, I think, I don't know, this is not today, some other time I did this. So if you just say Seattle, you get some number of pages, you know, 107 million, I guess. And if you say Seattle plus city, you get some other number of pages. And so if you take the ratio 24.7 million by 107 million, so that's like 23% probability that Seattle is a city. Notice that Seattle is not just a city. Seattle was an Indian chief. That's why Seattle, the city, became city. Okay. So clearly, it's a low probability that Seattle is a city. But, well, you might ask yourself, if you also figured out Seattle is a tomato, and you want to check whether or not Seattle is a tomato, it turns out that if you did the same thing for Seattle plus tomato, the probability of Seattle being a tomato is only 1%. So at least Seattle is 23 times more likely to be a city than it is likely to be a tomato. Okay. Now the interesting point that this also brings up is when you extract, in general, what you get out of extraction are probabilistic facts. All you can do right now is throw Seattle city 0.23 probability according to you. You see what I'm saying? And you may put some minimum threshold and say any fact which has a confidence lower than that, I won't even consider it a fact. But essentially, you will never be 100% sure. Right? Now, the other interesting thing is this technique can be improved further, actually. One of the things that you can do, so suppose you have something like Chicago, and I already mentioned Seattle. Is Seattle also an Indian chief? Suppose, you know, somewhere else you figured out Indian chiefs such as Seattle. Okay? And now you came up with another fact called Indian chief. Seattle is Indian chief. Now, if you try to figure out whether Seattle is an Indian chief, you get a very low value for that, because there are many more pages we are going to talk about Seattle being a city than Indian chief. And the same thing in this case, Chicago, you know, at the time this slide was made, there was this musical called Chicago that was, like, you know, very popular. So if you're talking about, if you somehow figured out from your extraction that movies such as Chicago, and so you extracted a fact called Chicago is a movie. Now, is it really a movie? Well, it's much more likely to be a city than a movie. And so the sense of cityness dominates the sense of moviness for Chicago. So to actually figure out that it's still possible for it to be a movie when it's not a city, what you need to do is something slightly more sophisticated, slightly more sophisticated, where you're taking the number of pages which have Chicago and are not about city is the denominator, and among those pages, how many of them are movies? Okay, that will give you a much better assessment of whether Chicago is also a movie than if you just directly did it upfront. Okay, and furthermore, actually, you can also, you can also, you don't have to jump at Seattle being a city just because it's just a city such as Seattle. You can also, in fact, there could be many symptoms of something being a city. Okay? Upfront saying cities such as Seattle, Seattle is a city. Okay? The baseball team from Seattle, so probably Seattle is a city. Okay? The crime rate in Seattle, probably Seattle is a city. Do you see what I'm saying? So each of these are features of it being a city. If it's a city, the word city would appear along with it. Maybe the word baseball will appear along with it. Maybe the word crime rate will appear along with it. Maybe the word the school district will appear along with it. And so in some sense, this is a naive-based classifier now. The Seattle is the class, the city is the class, and these are all the features. And so you can combine evidence from multiple features to actually improve your assessment of whether or not Seattle is a city. So this is one way. I mean, this is just one specific project that, you know, that was done at one point of time. But it's an interesting way of, it brings up this idea that when you are extracting, I mean, there are two points I want you to take away from this. One is that you are using the grammar, the NLP grammar, natural language grammar, to write extractors. Okay, and of course, unfortunately, those extractors are only sort of true. You know, sometimes they will give you false positives. And so then you have to separately evaluate the correctness of the fact. And even after that, you will only basically get facts which are probabilistically true. So in fact, if you're doing query processing on this database, then you are essentially handling probabilistic databases. Okay, that's the other point I made, that once you start extracting, you really only have uncertain data. Okay. It's not necessarily that Seattle being a city is in any doubt, but you don't know it. You are in doubt because the way you extracted it, it's iffy. Okay, so your sensory, your senses are, you know, I mean, you are either there or not there, and that's probably for sure, but I may not be able to see because of my bad eyesight. So my knowledge is uncertain, even though the your presence itself is certain. Okay. Yeah. No, this is sort of, I guess that's what you're talking about in terms of features. The question is, what are the features? I mean, I don't know what you mean random term.
No, I'm saying like, so you get a value of 23%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or 23% or whatever. Just take, like, so Seattle and associate with some random word, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then see what is the probability that you get.
That's what I was saying. Seattle is tomato with only 1% probability, but a city with 23% probability. Right? That's only telling you something. It's not telling you still whether Seattle is a city or not. It's just that it's more likely to be a city than a tomato. But maybe it's neither. Right? The whole point is that's the point about, I mean, it's probabilistic. The world is noisy. Your knowledge about the world is going to be probabilistic. And you come to terms with it. And, you know, databases are not deterministic anymore. Databases are going to be probabilistic. Okay? That's the whole point of this. Okay? So that's for that, now I'm going to shift. Are there any other, yes?
I was just wondering, can we directly go to like Wikipedia and search for that term? And
No. Again, the question of whether, so there is another way of extracting facts. So for example, you can extract facts from Wikipedia. This one is extracting facts directly from the web.
Do you mean that extracting facts from Wikipedia, right? Like Seattle is a city. You can get that on Wikipedia to find the accuracy of that, you know that Seattle is a city.
Yes, but the point is, that's probably, again, the fact that Wikipedia is a very useful source for assessing accuracy, it's a point well taken, okay? But there are certain things that still it doesn't contain. Okay, so for example, if I'm trying to extract facts, not common sense facts, let's say, but I'm extracting biological facts, they may not be present in the Wikipedia. Okay, another way is, so this one is sort of open information extraction. This sort of an idea is allowing you to extract information just from arbitrary text without being, you know, given any guarantees that, you know, this is structured information and that this has been curated by somebody. There are people who have also tried to do extraction of facts from, from Wikipedia. In particular, if you're doing extraction of facts from Wikipedia, the right thing to do would be to use the info boxes. Okay, that's in fact what I told you in the semantic web part, that whatever that name, I forgot already, the Infopedia, I think. It essentially writes all the facts in the Wikipedia info boxes into RDF form. Now, what's more interesting is there's also research, I mentioned that time, that there's also research which tries to generate Wikipedia info boxes automatically. Okay, so your point is ultimately, you know, why can't I just ask somebody who knows whether Seattle is a city or not, is ultimately what you're saying. So if that is possible, then you don't need to extract. You can just assume that there is some sort of a fact database already. Okay, when that's not possible, that's when you will wind up worrying about extraction. Okay, that's a good question. It's just whether or not you have curated, trusted sources, in which case that's like almost having a universal database that somebody, universal knowledge base of all the knowledge. Okay. So, any other questions? Okay. So, what I'm going to do now is basically go back to remember this picture from last class, where I said here is like a landscape of some extraction models, where, you know, sometimes if you're trying to extract, you know, entities from a closed set, it's very easy. You just check whether or not a member, and if you're looking for, you know, mentions of states in pages, and you want to see how popular is, let's say, Arizona compared to some other state, then, you know, this would work because you can actually talk about, you know, in each page, in each sentence, you're looking to see if the, you know, one of the states is mentioned. There are only 50 states. So that's closed, okay? And as you go forward, this one was already segmented here, and you're trying to classify the segmented information. So Abraham Lincoln, is it a name, or is it a place, or is it something else? Okay, and we also talked about if it's not already segmented, we can consider sliding windows. Okay, so you take some number of words at a time and try to give a class for it. And then, you know, slide a little and again take the window and classify it. And then as you go forward, you come to the sliding windows to boundary models where, you know, essentially both sides of the window are separately changed. And in fact, it's sort of a method that sort of, you know, subsumes them is essentially to think in terms of finite state machines. So the idea is that this sentence here really should be thought of in terms of its labels, okay? So Abraham Lincoln is basically, this one is essentially person, person, okay? Blah, 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 location. Okay, and now you may know that there is a grammar. Okay, now I'm using the word grammar in multiple instances. There's a grammar for Amazon page. And there is a grammar for the free text that appears on the Amazon page. That's the English grammar. And there is a grammar if I happen to know that all the sentences that I have are about people and the places where they are born. How would those sentences be structured typically? Now they probably might start with location and then blah 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 and the person, or person and then blah 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 location. Okay, so what I'm doing here essentially is a finite state machine where basically the way these sentences are generated, think of the generative model for these sentences. The way these sentences are generated is, here is a finite state machine which is talking, basically the reds are the person name, and the green, maybe the person's first name and the last name, and the green essentially is the location, and then this we don't care, we don't want to model it, any other word. And what this is saying is, if you are in the person's first name, you may have some more first name, you know, some more strings about the first name. After that, you tend to go to the last name, and after that last name, you may either go to some junk or directly go to the location. What's interesting here, of course, is this is, you know, a transition diagram. What matters actually is there will be probabilities associated with this. Okay, if I were to give you probabilities for the over these states, that for these transitions, what is that? It's a Markov chain. You know, right? Basically, it's a Markov chain. Now, the interesting thing is that you essentially are looking, if you were to write a grammar, okay, a particular kind of a grammar for these sentences could be a Markov model. Okay, now that's not enough. It turns out that nobody says, what's difficult about this problem is you don't know these states. You know only the words from those states. So what you observe are the words that could belong more likely to be first name, the words that might be more likely to be last name, and the words that are more likely to be, you know, location names. Given these observations, in essence, you're trying to figure out the actual states. When you figured out the state, you essentially figured out the class of the word. So if you look at this problem right now, I'm doing classification. This is just like, you know, I look at this part and I try to classify it. However, the interesting thing about this classification task is there is a sort of a constraint between the classes of nearby words. You typically don't have first name, location, last name. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's not just as if it's a set of classification tasks that are interconstrained. So that in some sense, you can then figure out whether or not your classification is good by checking whether those constraints are also satisfied. This is called a sequential, or essentially, in fact, the general name for it is collective classification. So you have a whole bunch of entities that you're trying to classify. But there is some, you know, constraints as to, you know, if this guy is class C1, this guy is more likely to be class C1. And this guy is class C2, this guy is less likely to be class C2. Okay? So each entity's label sort of constrains the label of its neighbor. In the collective classification, neighborhood is defined any which way. Okay, we are specifically considering collective classification in text flows, at least in English, left to right. It's a sequential classification. Okay, so this is basically what we call, what is this particular problem now, you know, extracting. Suppose if I were to extract from this that these two words are a person's name and this word is a location. I have extracted, you know, information. I have extracted a fact called Kentucky is a location. Abraham Lincoln is a person. I did this not from Amazon's text, but from basically, you know, text written by people without doing full natural language processing. What I did was I was looking at this Markov model gave me sort of the grammar for this subpart of the language. Okay? So this is what we're going to look at. So, you know, here's the Markov model, but then Markov model actually, you cannot see these states, so these are hidden states. And what you see instead is the observations from each of the states. And so what you have is a hidden Markov model, and I called it HMM fast last time, and a couple of people said, what is it that you're talking about? HMM is hidden Markov model. And we're going to look at a little bit about this. And it's a beautiful model, which has, you know, just as interesting, significantly more interesting in some sense than Markov chains, where it's fully observable, okay, and then you can use. Just as Markov chains are used across, you know, all sciences, hidden Markov models are used across all sciences. We are just using them for information extraction. Sequential labeling task in general is used in many situations. So for example, if you are trying to figure out what somebody just said, and what I heard is what a, you know, noisy phonemes. And did he really say this? Is the first question, you know. But what you're interested in is, like, given these phonemes, what exactly was the word that this person was trying to say? That's in speech recognition, okay. And basically, this, you know, it's also used in gene identification things, because genes are large sequences of letters. Okay, so it's a general task, and hidden Markov models, you know, are very useful. We'll just look at them mostly from the hidden, you know, information extraction application of that. Okay, so again, here is another example. The important thing is this is the finite state model. There are finite number of states, and there is probabilities from going from state to state, and the probability of going out of any state to every other state together has to be 1.0. Right, that's the usual thing. Okay, and then what's interesting, of course, is what's not being shown, and you know, I'll show you examples. It will make it much clearer. Is you will never see the states themselves. You will see when you are in this state, you are likely to send some observations. But those observations are sent probabilistically. Just because you are in the name state, you don't always send Abraham Lincoln as the name. Right, some names are going to be used more than others. Okay, so what you will get to see is things like, you know, the actual words that were output. Yesterday, Pedro Domingo spoke this example sentence, and this one, this grammar is basically saying, look, this is a complex way of writing a pattern. Remember, in the other place we said, if you ever see city such as NP1, NP2, NP3, you get to write it as fact NP1 is a city, NP2 is a city, NP3 is a city. Here, this is a much more interesting grammar. The grammar is essentially this Markov model. And from that, I'm going to be able to simultaneously classify a bunch of words. Okay, if I'm only interested in extracting certain entities, this is the named entity extraction. So for example, I'm interested in extracting all the names of the people from a bunch of text. Then I can use this grammar to figure out, okay, since yesterday Pedro Domingo spoke this example sentence, you know, I might be able to say, first try to, you know, give the states corresponding to this, assuming this is the grammar, what are the most likely states that would correspond to this. And then when you get the states, you know the classes. And whoever gets the red states, that's the name. Okay? Okay, and then in this particular case, notice that you don't really care about everything else. You know, all you cared in this case is the person name matters, the rest of the words are just don't care kind of a word. Okay? Here is a Markov model for paper titles. Okay? So, for example, you start, and then sometimes there'll be a note in the top of the paper before you get to see the title, okay? And then that's like low probability. Most higher probability you go to title itself. When you are in title, you know, you can write long titles, so you still stay in title for a bunch of time. After a bunch of time, you go from title to author. Right? And when you are an author again, you know, especially if you come from the part of the world I come from, you stay in author's name for a bunch of time because there are a large number of words in the author's name. Okay? And then you then get out of that and then you go to address, you go to date, email, blah, blah, blah. This is a grammar, a probabilistic grammar for how titles are written for paper. Title blocks are written. Similar probabilistic grammars might exist for US postal addresses, the way people write addresses. You see what I'm saying? Now, the interesting thing about it, it's not deterministic. You know, you tend to think that most papers will have title first, then author name, then, you know, then basically the address and, you know, and then the abstract and so on. But there are enough, exceptions that if you just take that literally, you're going to get junk as fact. Okay, so you have to, if you do this grammar, one of the questions that you have to have in the back of your mind is, who is sitting there and writing this grammar? Okay, and the answer to that is actually twofold. Who actually came up with the fact that these are the states? That means there's a note state, title state, author state, email state, affiliation state, address state, and so on. And who came up with the probabilities? Okay, it turns out that you have to come up with, the humans have to come up with the states. And there are easy ways, reasonably easy ways to learn the probabilities by learning. Okay, so that's smart HMM learning. Okay, yes?
Did humans come up with the transition too, or in the population?
Well, the interesting thing is, if they normally are supposed to put the transitions, but if they don't, you can always put all possible transitions and the ones that have close to zero probability can be removed and you can retrain the model. Okay, that's a very good question. For those of you who have thought of Bayes networks, I mean who have heard of Bayes networks, how many are there? This is basically all about Bayes networks. HMMs are a dynamic Bayes network. Okay, and basically when you are learning Bayes networks from the data, the question is, did somebody give you the topology and you just have to learn the conditional probability tables? Did you have to also learn the topology? And if you have to learn the topology, that's a much harder learning task than if you just have to learn the probabilities. In this case, actually, it turns out that even if they give the topology, the learning is still hard because you will never get, the data that you get will typically not be tagged in the learning time. There are two ways you can learn. One is somebody not only gave you the titles, but they actually segmented the titles into the correct states. It will be easier to learn these probabilities from that. More often than not, what you have is unlabeled data, in which case you essentially are doing hidden variable-based network learning because some of the variables are not known in the data. Okay, and you have to guess what their values are, and if the value is that, then you would have to guess what the likelihood of the words are, and then keep doing this repeatedly. In some sense, that's called the expectation maximization algorithm, and the closest you came to for that is k-means, and also that thing that I told you about earlier, where an I-based classifier uses additional unlabeled examples and goes through this cycle. Okay, but we'll get back to that, but essentially, suppose I gave you this grammar, okay? then what can I do with it? You know, how does it become useful for extraction? Yes.
This also looks like PageRank.
What?
This looks like PageRank.
Well, this is basically Markov chain. Right, you know, if somebody is speaking English out of this class, you can say this also looks like IR because I'm speaking English and they're also speaking English. It's just that we're both speaking English, you know, that's all, okay? It's a Markov chain, that's all. Okay, and you use Markov chain in PageRank, you use it in authorities and hubs, you used it, you are again using it now. That's just a mathematical abstraction. Okay, so actually I will be using an example mostly because I'm stealing Raymond Mooney's slides. I'm going to be using his example to make, you know, to go through some actual illustrations of HMMs. So in that example, I will be talking about part of speech tagging, which I assume was already done in the previous example. In the Seattle example, I assumed part of speech tagging was already done. Okay, it turns out that there are off-the-shelf part of speech taggers, but there's off-the-shelf everything. You don't have to actually use your brains anymore. You know, you just go pick up, you know, something and then, you know, let people use it. So, you know, there's HMM, what we're going to do here is, how would those part of speech taggers, how could they work? One way they could work is by HMM model. Okay, so basically, here, for example, I have, you know, I wrote a sentence and I have converted this, you know, part of speech tagging into, you know, the verb, proper noun, determinant, I don't know. And then noun and conjunction, verb, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So those are the states. Those are the states. Okay. And then I'm trying to figure out what states could have given rise to this sentence. If this sentence was grammatical, that's what you're trying to figure out. That's what part of speech tagging is. So when you're looking at this, think of this also as, I have a bunch of words and I'm trying to say, this is the name, first name, last name, title, and then our address. That's equivalent to this problem. I just wind up looking at this problem more, okay, for the examples for now. Okay. So here is a very simplified Markov model, Markov chain for the states here. Okay. So generally, all I am saying is that if you already used an article, you are less likely, and after the article, you are very likely to use a noun. Okay, like the city, you know, the class or something. Okay, city and class, all of these are nouns. Okay. There's a small probability that you can use a verb. The swimming in this place is not as good as it is somewhere else. Okay, so there is a small probability in terms of, normally when you hear an article, you expect to hear a noun right after that. But sometimes you might hear a verb. And the fact that you heard a verb doesn't mean that you're dead. It's still grammatically possible. And then when you go to verb, from verb you can go, apparently you can end half the time or other half point, 0.25 time you go to a proper noun, and another 0.25 time you go back to the. So this is interesting. Actually, you can look at this and see, you know, for example, the grammar that this particular fragment is, you know, providing. It's a reasonable grammar. Doesn't capture the entire English grammar, but it's a reasonable grammar. Now, if I give you this, then I can ask, what is the likelihood that a sentence will have proper noun followed by verb followed by determinant followed by a noun? Okay? And that is the joint probability of those happening. And that's basically just start, and you have to go to proper noun, 0.4 times. If from proper noun, you must go to verb. If any of those probabilities are zero, you know the rest of the entire probability is zero. So from proper noun, you have to go to verb, that's 0.8, 0.4 times 0.8 times 0.25 times 0.95 times 0.1, 0.0076. That's the likelihood that a sentence, you know, will have this particular part of speech, sequence of part of speech tags. Okay? That's what you could do with just this. Yes?
If you have that grammar right there, and I ask you, what is the most important part of speech in a sentence, would you
that's because you're thinking of, the moment you look at a Markov chain, you want to think of,
yes,
PageRank.
So would you go PageRank? Right?
That doesn't mean anything. I mean, you could
but
do
it
but
it,
I don't know why would it make sense.
It's like,
well, then you can use it for that. I mean, and then just use that and nothing else, you know. But that's basically not the only, I mean, so you're basically asking at the what is the steady state probability of finding yourself in this particular state? And that could have some useful application for language understanding, but it's much less likely to be, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. The question is anybody interested in the answer to that? If you were to go and tell somebody that more often than not, you are hanging around in the verb in an English sentence, you know, I mean, you can write one Newsweek article or a Washington Post article saying that, and then that's the end of that, you know. There's no real use for it every day. Okay? Yes?
Kind of needed some answer, but I think for this case, it would be thought if it's a thing
there. Good point. Okay. Yeah, that's actually a very good point. This one is actually, you know, this is a, you know, yes, with a sync node. This is a Markov chain with a sync node. Okay. So the hidden part comes because essentially you don't get to see the states, you get to see instances of the state. If you are in the articles, you might either say the or a or an. And if you are in noun, God help you, you're going to say any possible noun in the world. And if you are in verb, you're going to use any verb or its ending. Okay, and so on. Okay, so really, this is what you see. This is HMM. This is the most beautiful picture I can give you of HMM. Okay? So here are the, it's a Markov chain, of course, on these states. But each state is a bucket. When you are in that state, you know, you randomly pick one of those words and output it. And what comes out is the sentence formed by those words. And what you're trying to figure out is what states did you go through. Now, notice, for example, I don't know whether this happened here or not. In this case, it didn't happen. There could be words that can belong to multiple buckets. That's normally the interesting part. I can't actually see in this case. Do you guys see two buckets having the same word? In general, if you see a word in the way this is done, if I see a word, then I know pretty much what the state could have been. The ambiguity comes because the word can come from either this bucket or this bucket. That's normally what happens. In this example, that's not the case. Okay. But, you know, what I do see is the outputs of the words that are output. That's the observation. So this will be a generative model now for language. It's a particular form of generative model for the language. Okay. And what it's doing is, you know, I can run this. I start. Okay, and then I go to proper noun in this case, because I just basically toss a coin which comes this with 0.5 probability, this with 0.4 probability, this with 0.1 probability. It just happened to come red. So, I mean, this particular one, so I took this. Now when I go here, then I randomly pick one of these. And then output that. Okay, so John. And then having gone here, now the next thing I can go is only the ones that are allowed output from here. Okay, so I again consider all the possible ones and then pick one of them randomly, you know, where the choice is based on the probability there, and then I get here and then I pick one of the words there, John beat, and then I go from there to the, and then apple, and then stop. So I just generated John beat the apple. Okay, this is how the sentence got generated according to your model. Now the question that you would be asked to do is, if this is how sentences are generated, what's likely to be John? Is it a proper noun, or a noun, or a verb, or a determinant? Okay, and what is apple, what is bit, what is the? That's what you're trying to do. So your assumption is that the language is generated by this model, and I'm giving you a sentence, you're trying to figure out the parts of speech for the language. That's the whole point. Okay? Those are the computational questions that you're interested in answering with HMM. Yes?
Why do you need the binary
sequence
for that? Because the language is sequential, so you know the sequence already.
No, you don't know the sequence. That's the whole point, right? Here is a sequence, but basically, you know, if you look at if you go back here, right, it's not the case that right after noun you will always go to verb. You can end after noun sometimes. So it's a probabilistic grammar about how the sequence is generated. That's what it is. Okay? So it's a very interesting kind of a grammar. You know, obviously this is not the grammar of whole English language, right? But this is, if you assume that the grammar, remember we also assumed in certain other places, unigram model of the language. Right, where each word is just independently picked without caring about the other words. That's what bag of words model is. And if you can live with that, this is way more sophisticated. This actually has some grammar. It's much less sophisticated than the full English grammar. Okay, this is this idea of Chomskyan hierarchy of grammars. You know, this is some one of the lower level grammars. It's not even context-free grammar. Okay, but if you assume this, then you are able to at least capture some of the grammatical constraints and which you can then use to extract useful patterns. That's the point. Okay. So this is the formal definition of an HMM. And so essentially it's a Markov chain, okay, over states, but then you never see the states themselves. So there are n plus 2 states where n are the internal states and there's a start state and an end state. Okay, and then you need a state transition matrix. If you are in a particular state, what's the probability that it will go to one of the other states? That's one part of the matrix. Okay, that's one of the set of probabilities for this HMM. The other set of parameters for HMM is, if you are in a particular state, what is the probability that you will output a particular symbol? Okay, so here essentially I don't need to actually show you the bucket. I just need to say that if you are in proper noun bucket, then the probability that Jerry could be output is 0.000001. Okay, whereas the probability that the would be output when you are in the proper noun bucket is close to zero. I mean 0.0001 is close to zero, you might think, but in fact when you're doing these kinds of analysis, all of them are very close to zero, and in fact it's much better, you're much better off doing logarithms of these numbers. Okay, so just a second, so essentially so then you have the parameters corresponding to the state transitions and the parameters corresponding to, if you are in the state, what's the likelihood that you will get an observation, a particular observation. And if I give you this information, then I have specified the HMM completely. I need to tell you what the states are, I need to tell you what the state transition probabilities are, and I need to tell you, if you are in a particular state, what the probability that you will get, a certain observation. Okay? Now, this is HMM, and of course, you know, if I can directly see the state, that's the Markov model, so this part would not be there. And in fact, you can easily see that Markov chain is a special case of HMM, where if the state outputs itself, imagine that each state has one single observation, which is its own name, and it outputs that with 1.0 probability, then that's HMM, where it's a Markov chain. It's a more general model. Okay, now to generate a sequence of T observations from this Markov chain, all you do is you start from the start state, from 1 to T, you transit to another state using the probabilities. And when you are in that state, you using the probability of observations, you output an observation. So you have a many-sided coin whose probabilities are coming, you know, the outcomes, probabilities are determined by this transition matrix. Okay, so that's what is happening. This is the assumption you have about how these sentences are being made. Okay? Now, if that is the case, then what are the problems that we are interested in solving? The problems we are interested in solving are three problems. Now, there may be more problems, but these three are most interesting. The one problem that he's interested in, which is, you know, what's likely to be the tag of the state, most likely tag of a state in English language, might be one. But the ones that we are interested in, actually, for the information extraction point of view, and it's also true for most HMM applications, is first, given an observation, given a sequence of words, how likely is that sequence of words? Remember, I already computed a sequence of states probability. Given a sequence of states, computing the probabilities of that sequence of states is very easy, just multiplication of probabilities. But what I typically get is the words, are basically the observations. given a set of observations, how likely is that observation? Now the interesting thing there is you can't just assume that the observation can only be made by one particular state. Multiple states could have given this observation with different probabilities. Right? Okay? So that's one thing. Okay? And in fact, it turns out it's also useful in figuring out if there are two possible grammars that you are considering for this particular task. You know, like you think that paper title blocks are made with this grammar, your friend has a slightly different grammar. Okay, what you can see is which is more likely grammar for, you know, the paper in a DBLP repository. What you would do is you would compute the real paper's likelihood with respect to this guy's, your model, and you know, her model. And whichever gives higher probability to the true papers is the more likely grammar. You see what I'm saying? Because ultimately, if everybody is using wrong grammar, then that becomes the grammar. There is no wrong grammar anymore. Okay? So that's essentially the first question that you could use, that you want like a computational solution for that. The second question for which you want a computational solution is really the most interesting one from our point of view, is if I just saw a sequence of words, what is the most likely sequence of states that generated those sequence of words? Because the moment I got the state, that's the classification. Right? So remember, you know, tomorrow Pedro Domingos is giving a lecture in Wien Hall. Okay? And if I were to say that blah, name, blah, blah, location, then I'm able to extract a location as well as a name from this. In one fell swoop. Right? Okay? So this is the most likely state sequence. Okay, given a set of observations, what is the most likely state sequence that could have caused these observations? And this is actually a very famous problem, and the algorithm for this, we'll see in a minute, is called the Viterbi decoding algorithm. And how many of you know Viterbi? How many of you know Qualcomm? Okay, that's what makes you non-computer scientists. You should know more of Viterbi than Qualcomm, because Viterbi started Qualcomm. Okay, right. Okay. Viterbi was a communications theorist, and he was interested in the problem back in 60s, was interested in the problem of if I were to send a signal, okay, which is made up of zeros and ones, and because of the transmission noise, some ones become zeros, some zeros become ones, and I still got my sequence here. I'm trying to figure out from what I got, what was actually sent. That's decoding, right? This is why it's called decoding. So you're trying to decode the message that was sent on a noisy channel. Okay, and he essentially came up with the idea of HMMs. He didn't call them that much, but you know, basically he came up with the idea of HMMs, and he wrote a very efficient algorithm for decoding. We'll see why it's efficient, because the dumb way of doing it is exponential, and it turns out because of the Markov property of the Markov model. What's the Markov property? No. What's the Markov property of the Markov chain? Exactly. That's what the Markov property is. The first order Markov means the probability that you go from this state to another state depends only on this state, not on how you got here. Do you see what I'm saying? And so it's like path independent, only state dependent. Okay? And because of the Markov property of the Markov chain, you can do much better than the dumb idea that we'll come up with first. Unfortunately, I won't explain to you the smarter idea, but you know, doing the smarter idea makes it only quadratic in the number of states. Okay, and Viterbi came up with it, and he's well known in the literature for Viterbi decoding algorithm. And then he also did, of course, Qualcomm, and he's well known in the financial community and in my class, unfortunately, for starting Qualcomm and not for Viterbi decoding. Okay. He's also, I think, you know, he used to be a professor in USC, and so he just bought the department, and he said Viterbi School of Engineering. You know, he just must have used loose change or something, and you know, bought it up. But anyway, the third thing that you are interested in is something that I already mentioned, which is who comes up with these crazy looking grammars and their numbers. That's the learning part. Okay, and there is essentially the easy method is to assume that training data which has already been tagged is available, in which case it's basically counting numbers, you know, ratios, computing ratios. And the more realistic thing is I only know the transition diagram and I don't know actually which, even in the training data, I don't know which word corresponds to what state. Then you need to do essentially something like EM, you know, expectation maximization algorithm, where you guess some probabilities for the states, and then based on that, you compute the probabilities for the observations and keep repeating this while trying to increase the likelihood of the observation. Okay, that's the thing. And in fact, there's an algorithm called Baum-Welsh algorithm, which is well known for that part. Okay, so there's Viterbi for this, Baum-Welsh for that. Okay, mostly I'm going to tell you these are the three problems that are interesting for HMMs, and there are algorithms for doing it. You know, if I had more time, I would have tried to explain to you those algorithms. To really understand them, essentially you need a little bit more background in Bayes networks and probability theory. But you know, you get a good enough idea of why people like HMMs in information extraction tasks. Anyway, so a little more about these particular problems. So the first one is observation likelihood. So given a sequence of observations O and the model with a set of parameters, you know, HMM model with a set of parameters, what is the probability that this observation was generated by this model? That's what you're trying to compute. Notice that instead of giving observations, if I gave you the states, the sequence of states, this is a trivial problem. This is just multiplication of all the probabilities. Because it is the observation, since the observation could have been generated with multiple states, you don't quite know what is the likelihood of this observation sequence. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the way to, and this, as I said, this is useful, of course, in actually figuring out if I heard, you know, two sentences, because of the wrong transmission, I heard two versions of the same sentence, and I could figure out which one is more likely to have been said. Which sentence could have been more likely to have been said. Okay. Then the other, also basically is comparing the two models. If you have two models that generate the same sentence, whichever gives the higher probability that for that model, that sentence is a more likely model. That's what I was saying earlier. Okay. So in this case, they were just looking, you heard a series of phonemes, Austin, is it more likely to be Boston or more likely to be Austin? And this is the way people would say Austin. Here is interesting, this is a grammar in terms of phonemes as to how different people say Austin. I mean, I say it my way, you say it your way, and then Boston too, there are multiple different ways of saying Boston. And so it's not surprising that if some random sequence which sort of sounds like Boston and Austin is heard, you're trying to figure out which one is more likely to have been said. And if it's generated by this, if its probability by this is higher than the probability by this, then it's generated by this. That's the idea. Now notice here that the grammars here are in terms of the phonemes for the individual words. So we're just drilling down to, you know, lower and lower levels. And so that too is used in HMM. Okay. Let me see, did I show you an example for this? Okay. Yeah.
Let's say, to the next question, I mean, the start state and the end state should be always same because you can never come back to this graph if the starting letter is B.
No. We are talking about phonemes here. We are not talking about you are in English, right? English, you don't have to pronounce anything. You know, just because the word letter B is there doesn't mean that you have to actually say B. Okay? We are talking about just the phonemes. So again, these are the issues. Most likely sequence also, if I have multiple sequences that could have been said, so Vice President Gore or Vice President Gore, you sure you heard one of these? Which one is more likely to have been said, given the grammar? And hopefully your grammar will say this is more likely than this. Okay? Yes.
So this would be really useful in like phone recognition systems. And they're trying like so if they're expecting you to stay a month or something.
Yeah.
Then they know what the set is. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. HMMs were actually used very highly in speech recognition. The if you look for hidden Markov models on Google Scholar, the paper with like the you know ton of citations is a paper by Rabiner. Rabiner basically was a speech recognition guy from AT&T Labs. You know, so that's where they were used a lot there. So here is a dumb way of doing it. You know, let's get this going. Okay. So if I have given you a sequence of observations and you're trying to figure out how likely is that sequence of observations to be generated by an HMM, notice that they are not states. If they are states, it's just a simple multiplication. But the fact that if they are states, it's only a simple multiplication tells me a way of doing it, which is first figure out all possible states. If my sequence is of length t, first figure out all possible state sequences of length t. Compute the probability of each of those state sequences, because you know how to do it. And since you know the state, then since you know the exact state, aligned state, you know, this is the state for this word, this is the state for this word, this is the state for this word, then you can compute what is the probability that this word would have been output for this word would have been output for this state, which is yet another multiplication. Okay? Multiply those two, you get one way of getting this sequence. Because of this state sequence. But this state sequence can come, this particular word sequence can come either from this state sequence or this other state sequence or this other state sequence. Each of them have different probabilities of being the original state sequence, and each of them will, if they were the true true state sequence, will have a small probability of generating these words. Since these are all mutually exclusive and exhaustive, because one sequence is different from another sequence, you can add up these numbers. This is sort of like, you know, figuring out, you know, how many people are sleeping in the class, let's say. Then I want to say, well, split the people into, you know, men and women. And then compute the probability that men are sleeping, and compute the probability that women are sleeping, compute the probability that there are men in the class, and compute the probability that there are women in the class. Then I'll get, you know, the probability that people are sleeping. Right? That's what I'm doing here. You know, read this carefully. Basically, this is like the obvious idea. You should at least understand this. The problem with this is that since you are considering all possible state sequences, there are n state sequences, and you are looking, there are n states, and there is a sequence of length t. So each point in that sequence, you know, any of n states can come. So n times n times n times n, n power t. And once I give you a state sequence, computing the probability of the words given that state sequence is yet another t multiplication. Right? Okay? So essentially it's of the order of t times n power t. That's the computation cost of figuring out the likelihood of a sequence of words, a sequence of observations given the HMM. Now obviously if this was the best algorithm, we wouldn't be talking about it. Especially since you're supposedly using this, you know, on large scale for information extraction tasks. The interesting thing is because of the Markov property, you can use dynamic programming techniques. And because of that, you can go directly from t times n power t to t times n squared. If I just showed you t times n squared, you'll be greedy and say, why n squared, why not n, why not log n, why not log n. But if I show you n power t to begin with, then you say, my God, I just dodged a bullet, you know, because I would have been spending time figuring this out otherwise. Okay? So there is a nice algorithm that you can write using dynamic programming techniques that will compute this in quadratic time. And that's useful. Okay. The second question is most likely state sequence. That is, if I just give you the sequence of observations, you want to compute what is the state sequence that would have been the most likely state sequence given these observations. Okay? Obviously, this problem is sort of related to the probability of states, because in one way you can do this is again compute all state sequences and compute for each of the state sequences how much probability will this particular sequence of words have with respect to that state sequence and pick the one that gives the maximum probability for the observation. And that would be the state sequence you want. Once again, using Markov property, you can do this in n square time. That's the Viterbi decoding part. Okay, so you're computing only the state sequence. So you're computing the one state sequence. In some sense, this problem, so here, you know, example here is if I have something like John gave the dog an apple, I'm trying to figure out that the best parse for it with respect to this grammar is that this is det, this is noun, proper noun, verb, and so on. That means if this was the state sequence, this would have been proper. This is the most likely state sequence. This is the highest likelihood that this is a sequence which would have generated this particular set of words. Okay? So remember that would take into account the probability of the state sequence itself times the probability that this state sequence will generate this. This is a computation we did earlier, except you also added up numbers across state sequences in the previous case. Here I just want to do a max on the state sequences to figure out the most likely state sequence. So not surprisingly, if that thing can go from n power t to n square, this too can go from n power t to n square, because it's just a max operation on the same problem. And this is the problem that's called Viterbi decoding, and this is the one that you are most interested in some sense, for information extraction. Because really what you wanted to do is, given a sequence of words, figuring out what states would have generated those words. Given a sequence of words, I should be able to say, for example, this is the first name, last name, address 1, address 2, city, and so on. Okay? And so using that, you can then compute, essentially, in one fell swoop, you are classifying all the words into their labels, such that one of the interesting things is the most likely label for a single word might be different from its label in the most likely sequence. As I'm speaking, you could have sworn that the second word I said sounds like vice president. Vice, B-I-C-E. That's the highest likelihood that my second word I just said is vice. Okay? But then the most likely sequence of words I said is vice president good. So the you are not trying to figure out what did people say, you know, as the fourth word and fifth word. You're trying to figure out what is the sentence they said. Okay? And so once again, in trying to decide the sentence, you actually have to care about the constraints coming from the neighbors. And that's where the collective classification comes. Right? Because it's not just, I'm not trying to classify just this word in isolation. This word in isolation is more likely to be biased than anything else. But this word in conjunction with all these other words is more likely to be biased. And the same thing for titles. And, you know, titles of papers or address labels or whatever. Right? You know, for example, bishop, you know, is it a name or a road name? Is it a person name or a road name? Well, it depends, right? Bishop is probably likely to be Smith in particular. Okay, Smith, is it a person's name or a road name? Well, it's overwhelmingly likely that Smith is a person's name. But then there are enough Smith lanes and Smith avenues and Smith drives. It's just that in an address block, if you already gave something as a person's name, why do you need one more person? So it's more likely to be a street name now. Even though if you just look at Smith in isolation, it's more likely to be a person's name. So that is what you're getting from the grammar of the address label. Okay? So the last thing that we care about, and you know, I already mentioned this, so I won't go into too much detail on this, is how do you learn this structure, this grammar that you came up with? The assumption nowadays is you essentially, first of all, somebody has to come up with the FSM model. You know, I showed that ugly state transition diagram for the labels, for the paper titles. You have to come up with it. You have to come up with the topology. But I could use learning to figure out the transition probabilities. Okay, and as I mentioned earlier, it becomes easiest if the learning is done on completely labeled data. That means you not only, your training data not only has addresses, but the addresses are split into this is the first name, this is the last name of the person, this is the street name, this is the house number, this is the city name, and this is the zip code. Once I have done that, then essentially I have something like this. So I have not only data, John at the apple, a dog bit Mary, etc., but I also label them that, you know, the red ones are determinants, the greens are nouns, the blacks are proper nouns, and the pinks are verbs. If I did this, now I have labeled data, and now computing the probabilities is just supervised learning. It's just like knife-based classification learning, you know, where you compute these kinds of ratios. Okay, that's easy. And I will stop here, you know, and a good note that in fact you can compute these probabilities if somebody else does your work. Although I would wonder why somebody did this much and didn't do this, right? Why did not they do the ratio also? And why not just give you the numbers also, okay? So it's too much to expect in some sense, okay? And what really happens normally is you get probably only partly labeled or completely unlabeled data, and then you essentially are doing Bayes network learning. You know, Hidden Markov model is a Bayes network. It's Bayes network learning where the examples you are observing don't tell you the values for the interior nodes. The state's values are not known. So then you need expectation maximization. And that's what Baum-Welsh algorithm does. The interesting thing there is it combines the inference, you know, EM algorithms combine inference and learning steps. So guess a value for the parameters, do inference. Based on the inference, reset the values for the parameters, do inference again. When you reset, you did learning. When you did inference, you're doing essentially HMM-based, you know, evaluation of the likelihood of a state sequence. Okay, so we will stop here. Next class, we will go to a different topic, which is basically information integration.